Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto. This is a monthly podcast about caving or wild cave exploration. If you've stumbled upon this podcast and you're interested in caving, but you've never done it before, I encourage you to find a local chapter of the National Speleological Society. We call them grottos, and you can do that at caves.org. Caving can be dangerous if you're unprepared or inexperienced, but extremely fun and rewarding if you do it safely. So find some experienced people to take you underground on your first few trips so you can learn how to do it right. Speaking of first-timers, my guest today has introduced a great many first-time cavers to the sport who have then continued caving seriously, myself included. Paul Uglum took me on my first wild cave trip 6.5 years ago, and I have been in love with it ever since. We'll get into that in a few minutes. First, where have I been recently? Well, I just went caving this past Sunday. I took a horizontal trip to Salt's Cave near Mitchell, Indiana. It's about a 5,000-foot cave on private property in the Hoosier National Forest. It's a great little cave. And speaking of beginners, I took a friend of mine who is also a coworker on her very first trip in that cave this past Sunday. She's been curious about it. Whenever I would bring it up, she said, when are you going to take me? And so I finally got a chance to, and she had a great time. It's always great when you can tell that a first-timer really enjoyed it. I think we may have a new caver on our hands in my coworker, Abby. I also took my sister-in-law, who I also introduced to caving a few months ago and who has since graduated to doing vertical. And since it was such a small group, it was just the three of us, we were able to move quickly and actually saw most of the cave. And we went to parts I'd never seen before, despite having been there in that cave several times before. And this was the best part. I saw four Hoosier cavefish in the cave. Four Hoosier cavefish, which is a lot like the northern cavefish, but as described by Dr. I think Prasanta Chakrabarty from Louisiana, he described some differences between the northern cavefish and cavefish found in Indiana. So now it's known as the Hoosier cavefish. Anyway, that's more cavefish than I've ever seen on a single trip, and they were just mesmerizing to watch. Great trip this past Sunday. And an Indiana classic. I'd recommend Salt's Cave to anyone visiting the state. If you've got an inn with some Indiana cavers who know the landowner, try to check it out. Earlier this month, I also hit up a classic Indiana vertical spot, Freeman Pit. And that was where I took my sister-in-law on her first vertical trip. It's a 97-foot pit near Bloomington, Indiana. She was nervous, as we all were on our first vertical, but she did great, and she wants to do it again. Let's see. Oh, 2 weekends ago, I was down in Kentucky's Red River Gorge, did some hiking and some rappelling, and got some friends of mine to come with me. That was the first place I ever went rappelling, and it's a spot I could not recommend highly enough to anyone who likes the outdoors. It was pretty crowded, you know, people trying to get in the last few good days of fall, but we got some good tranquility and recharged the battery, so to speak. This weekend, I'm going to Buddha Cave with Charlie Vetters, the vice chairman of the Central Indiana Grotto, so that we can kind of reacquaint ourselves with the cave. We're both going to lead a grotto trip there later this month, so we figured that gave us an excuse to go down there and go through it. It is one of the prettiest caves in Indiana. If you've got the 1992 NSS Convention Guidebook, the color picture on the front of the guidebook is Buddha Cave. It's a cave whose entire lower level is just nothing but formations, huge, gorgeous formations, and it's owned and managed by the Indiana Karst Conservancy. So that's definitely one you'd want to check out if you make it to Indiana for some caving. It's got some vertical to it, just a 30-foot drop down into the lower level. So you got to know your vertical if you're going. Can't wait to for this weekend to do that. The Caving Podcast is sponsored by Swago. If you're a serious caver and you do survey work, you know that there's a lot of awkwardness shining your light on your compass or your clinometer as you look through the eyepiece so you can get your reading. Swago has got a really great product for that, the Sight Light. Sight Lights are these little glow-in-the-dark wedges that fit Suunto compasses and clinometers, specifically the KB14 compass and the PM5 clinometer, and it also fits the Tandem. You just shine your headlamp on the instrument for like a second, and it's charged, and it's bright enough for you to take your reading without shining a light through it, so you can take your reading single-handed. And Swago sight lights are just $5. $5 for a pair. So get them at swagogear.com and check out the sight light shields and Swago's other gear while you're there. If you like the Caving Podcast, support the show by supporting our sponsor, Swago. All right, let's get to it. Let's talk to longtime caver and expert with beginners, Mr. Paul Uglum. Paul Uglum, welcome to the Caving Podcast. How are you?
Excellent. Thank you for having me.
You are a chemist by trade, but you are also a caver. You're currently the cave patron of Sullivan Cave near Springville, Indiana.
Very nice cave.
Yeah. So, and that was the very first cave I ever visited, and that was with you. You introduced me to caving back in the spring of 2010.
Ancient times.
It wasn't that long ago. You seem to you tend to lead beginner trips. You tend to introduce people to caving and are very successful with it. I can think of a few friends that you and I have gone caving with that did their first real trip with you, and it just kind of the bug, it stuck with them. Do you think that you have any kind of power with that? Like any kind of special power?
I think it's mostly just willingness to take beginners caving. A lot of cavers are reluctant. Beginners tend to be a little more of a hassle than experienced cavers.
I certainly was my first trip.
You weren't that bad. You were entertaining. There's a difference between hassle and entertaining. Entertaining is fun. And I do it with all age groups. I've been caving. I was trying to think about that this morning for 48 years.
48 years?
I started when I was in high school, and I lived in an area with caves, and there was holes in the ground. I said, gee, that looks sort of interesting. I think I'll crawl in there, much to my parents' chagrin. And then I invited some friends, and they thought it was fun too. And then I got hooked up with some folks at the University of Wisconsin. Wisconsin Speleological Society, which is one of the NSS grottos, and did a lot of caving with them, and then went off to college and grad school and continued to cave there. Mostly I got involved with beginners maybe in the last 20 years. Youth groups in particular would take out scouts and church groups, folks that had never been caving. With the CIG, I was looking for the beginners. One of the things I saw there is there weren't a lot of opportunities for beginners. The experienced cavers want to go to fun, and they call them sporty caves.
Oh, yeah.
And the beginners think, I'm going to die in this hole type cave. And they're more challenging. Or they are project cavers. They've got a program. They're trying to map a cave, a new system. And those are fairly rigorous caving experiences, not what you want to start with as a beginner.
No.
So I just saw the gap and started to set up beginner trips and met some excellent people doing it, lots of professionals.
Well, I think that you are like me in that you are content to go back to the same spots over and over again, and you know what you like, and you know the cave, and you know you're going to have a good time regardless of who's with you and their experience level.
That's true. You have to be willing to go back to some of the same caves because there are certain ones that by scale, length, difficulty are really good ones for beginners. They can show them what it's like in a non-hazardous way, and they are scalable. Sullivan's is a really good cave because it is very scalable. That can be a really, really difficult cave for some people. If you go, you can take a 10, 12-hour trip requiring a wetsuit, or you can do a beginner trip with first graders. I took a group of first graders once, and that was really entertaining. Because with first graders, I required each kid to have one dad or mother. And you remember the backbreaker. It's a nice passage, except for it's only about 3.5 feet tall, which means you're all walking bent over. Unless you're a first grader.
Unless you're a first grader.
You're standing up and you may be just barely touching the ceiling and you're walking down that hallway having a great time and moving at a fairly good clip. All the dads who are out of shape, some of them are in great shape, some of them are tall, which isn't great for a 3.5 foot tall passageway, are walking bent over going, slow down, stop.
A lot of jealousy of youth and height.
Yes, yeah, it was one of the more entertaining trips. And I've done that a couple times with some fairly young ones. And that's a cave that's very easy for that because it's all pretty much walking passage. The climb downs at the entrance are fairly short, so you just have two dads and you pass the kids down. And once you're down into the cave, you can walk along and have a great adventure.
Are you familiar with, would you say, most of Sullivan Cave? Like, have you been up the big river passage or anything like that?
I'm not as familiar as I'd like to be. I picked up being the patron because there was a gap. And they needed somebody to watch over that cave.
And you use that cave a lot.
I was pretty familiar with all of the front end of the cave. I've been up to the quarry room just a little bit beyond it. I've been down through the Speed Hollow entrance, kind of the caver's baptism. Not something you'd want to do unless you're taking older cavers, because jumping down a little hole into 9 feet of water is a little bit scary for most people. But you're right near the entrance at that point. Something you also want to do during the summer, since it is no fun climbing over a hill through the woods when you're dripping wet in winter.
But people have done it.
People have done it. First time I went out, it was pretty cold and pretty late in the year.
Oof.
And on top of that, I think it was with Dean Wiseman, and one of the questions was, well, which hill do we climb over? So get the compass out and figure out where we're going next.
Before we start moving.
Yeah.
Before we spend too much time out here in the elements.
You're going the wrong direction at night in the woods.
You mentioned Wisconsin and how there were caves where you grew up. Whereabouts was that?
South of La Crosse, north of Prairie du Chien. It's called the Driftless Area. There was an area in Wisconsin, Iowa, and Minnesota where the glaciers split. And that left a very hilly area, an area with exposed limestone, and an area with some very nice caves. Minnesota probably has the best of them. But that part of Wisconsin, Minnesota right across the river, Iowa just a little bit to the south, have a lot of very interesting caves, both wet ones and multi-level caves.
Wow. So what were your favorite caves there in Wisconsin?
Esches, there was one called Bosque Bel Bear. There's a fun one that the grotto would go to that's called Bootlegger, I think. It basically had three entrances. So it was, you go in one, you get lost, you have people coming out in the three entrances and trying to collect them, get them back together at the end was a bit of a challenge. So,
how long are some of the systems there in that area?
Fairly short by comparison to Indiana. Indiana's got, obviously, every state has some short caves, but Indiana's got some up in the 40-mile range, and Sullivan's is obviously 7-8 miles of cave. More typically, they're under a mile. In Wisconsin, they're a lot shorter than that. Minnesota has some nice long ones.
Yeah. Minnesota, really? I mean, I obviously have a lot to learn, but I didn't know that Minnesota had a ton of caves.
Not a ton, but they're concentrated in an area near where I could get to them easily, which made it nice. You won't find them in the north, you won't find them in the west, but on the southeast corner of Minnesota, you'll find caves.
So you probably just kind of poked around when you first got started. Do you remember the first cave you ever visited like that?
Yeah, it was called Star Valley. It was an interesting cave. It's up on top of a hill. My father knew the farmer, and they discovered that one when they were chasing a skunk. It went down a little hole. They couldn't get the hole open, so they stuck a stick of dynamite in it and blew it open. And it was the entrance to a cave. And it was a nice little system. It had basically a Y shape with a couple of cross passages between the Ys and a few small rooms and nice formations. So it was a nice little cave.
That was the first cave you ever went in, you think?
It was the first non-commercial cave.
Oh, okay.
I think as younger, I'd gone to some of the commercial caves, and that's one of the things folks don't realize, commercial cave is not a real cave in the sense of what caving is like.
Right.
It's lit paths. It is generally flat surfaces. It's steps and it's handlebars. And
walking upright.
Like, and it's pretty mild. Yeah. Caving can be a lot more rigorous.
So do you know off the top of your head what your NSS number is? How long have you been a member?
I've been a member for about 45 years.
Okay, so you've been
46.
Caving 48 years, been an NSS member about 46 years.
Yep.
Wow. Goodness. So you're probably in the four-digit range, you think?
No, I'm in the 13,000 range.
13,000. Gotcha. All right, 10-4. I'm like 65,000.
Yeah. A few years have passed between those two.
Obviously.
But yeah, I was involved in, when I got involved with the Wisconsin Grotto, the Wisconsin Speleological Society, at that point it was located at University of Wisconsin-Madison. The current organization is now on the far east side of the state. But at that time we were doing a lot of mapping. We found some new caves, which was kind of fun, and mapped several that had not previously been mapped or at least officially known. Generally, the owner knows he's got a hole in the ground.
Right.
Cavers may or may not know that. And as you locate them and find them, one of the things we try to do is map them as well as explore them.
When was the last time you were up in that area doing some caving?
I haven't been caving there for quite a few years.
Yeah.
I get up there, I generally am visiting family or doing work on my mom's farm. There's always something to do there.
So you still got family up there.
Yeah, still have
got
family
connections.
Up there.
Yeah. When would you say you were hooked? It doesn't sound like it took that long.
No, I was hooked decades ago. I was hooked fairly early. High schoolish, I was. But that was a fun sport. I wanted to stay involved with it. And it offers a lot. It's it offers a chance to climb, a chance to explore, to see the unknown, to do something unusual. The formations and decorated caves are just spectacular at some times. It's just a fun sport.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that gets into my next question, and that is why? Why do you like doing it? What is it that hooked you?
I think the sense of adventure. It's something that is outside of normal. I've always liked the outdoors. I backpack, I canoe, kayak. So it's just another part of that spectrum of sports that you can do in the outdoors. And it offers a lot of the things the others do. Going someplace people don't normally see, it is physically challenging. I like the vertical work, so I like to do rope work and vertical caves. And I did some of that fairly early in Wisconsin, too, although I'll say that techniques are much safer. Ropes are much nicer now than they were 50 years ago.
Were you climbing with knots and doing all that? Or
I was using prussic to ascend.
Yeah.
As far as descending, that was actually kind of pre-racks or just as racks were starting to come in. So I'd use two carabiners with brake bars in the carabiners across the gates, which is considered a big no-no now. It loads the gates. It is considerably more risky than a rack, but still controlled by variable friction.
Sure.
And there are a few interesting caves in Wisconsin. There's not as much vertical in Wisconsin. Indiana's not bad. We've got some 100-foot, 140-foot pits. Wisconsin are generally in the 60 or under range.
Something like that.
Yeah. But still enough you could get hurt if you don't know what you're doing.
Absolutely you could. Do you have any favorite trips that you look back on from those days, particularly favorite caves in Wisconsin?
There were some really interesting ones. There's one called Wazika Crack that was really interesting down in just near the Prairie du Chien area. There were a couple others. There's a collapsed dome cave, which was really interesting. You entered through a manhole. You walk out in the woods, and there's basically a manhole-sized hole in the middle of a rock. So you'd rig your ropes and rappel down, and it was a large collapsed room. It was a little like Fuzzy Hole with a much smaller hole.
Fuzzy Hole is a big pit here in Indiana that's like a huge entrance. I've actually never been there. You've been there a couple times.
Yeah. It's a large room that collapsed.
Yeah.
And basically the whole room collapsed, so you've got a very large round entrance that you rappel down into. From top to bottom, it's about 100 feet. You actually only rappel maybe 30, 40 feet, but it's got some steep sides. It's very pretty. One of the few caves I see hummingbirds in because it collapses. It's got this big mound of dirt with plants in the center, and so the summer you'll have flowers, and the hummingbirds will be down there sampling the flowers.
So you would say then that you've been doing vertical for how many of the 46 years you've been caving?
I started doing vertical when I was in college, so maybe when I was 19 or so.
40-plus years ago.
Yeah, you know, definitely 40-plus years ago. And then I got out of it for a while. I was doing it for a while because I had – with vertical, you need other people who, are willing to do it and
sure.
who have the time. And then I got out of it, and I got back into it a number of years ago because it's just plain fun, and the gear has improved immensely.
Well, you climb with a Mitchell, which is a little easier than Knott's or Frog, right?
It's easier than both. I have both a Frog and a Mitchell. And on our trip to Tag recently, I used both. But I like the Mitchell. It's much more energy efficient. And it works well for the Tag-type pits and most of the ones in Indiana. If you're against a wall, the Frog is better. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to be doing a lot of crawling and then have drops inside of a cave, the Frog is just lighter, easier to move with.
Well, you recently took your first trip down to Tag.
Yeah, I should have gone years ago.
Right? It's too much fun. Those are your deepest pits so far, about in the 180 range?
Yeah.
What'd you think of that?
Oh, I love Tag. Yeah. I need to be doing more of that. I've been to some really interesting caves around the world. I've done a variety of the caves on several of the islands in Hawaii, the two longest lava tubes in the world.
That's another thing. You are a traveling man. You've been all over. You've been caving, obviously, in the United States and in Hawaii. Have you been caving elsewhere?
No, not too much. Usually, unfortunately, since I travel for business, I don't often have as much time. Or I'm traveling with my wife, who doesn't cave. So in those cases...
She's been once, though, right? You took her once.
I took her once when we were dating, and she married me, and she said,
you.
I'm not going to go caving again. That was a wild cave. We've gone to some commercial caves.
Of course.
She doesn't mind that. But wild cave was just not to her liking.
No. And it's not for everybody. It certainly is not. Let's see. So tell me about Hawaii then.
Hawaii is lava tubes. And there are other great places to do lava tubes in the United States too, up in Oregon, the El Mal Pass down in New Mexico, Arizona area. And I've done some up in Arizona as well, up near the Flagstaff area. But Hawaii is, the Big Island has a lot of really nice caves. There is a Hawaiian conservancy, very similar to the Indiana Cave Conservancy, or maybe closer to a grotto, and they're doing a lot of mapping. One of the guys that is the leader for that, Roger Eldred, is on the Big Island, and he has some of the entrances to the second longest lava tube in the world. So I was caving with him when I was over there a number of years ago, and we went into Eli's Pit Cave. We were sampling some of the minerals. They were trying to date the cave. They had dated it using carbon dating from some of the torches that the early Hawaiians had used in that cave.
Wow.
And that was saying that didn't match with when they thought the lava flow was. They were coming in older than when they thought the lava flow was. So we were sampling a few of the minerals on the wall so that we could determine if which date was right. And so that was going to be an interesting one. But it was a very interesting, it's a mazy cave. So high on the mountain, you'll get railroad tunnels, you know, these long, straight lava tubes that you think of when you're thinking lava tube.
They kind of grade downward.
Okay. They're generally very near the surface, so you get collapses, so you can get into them fairly easy. When you get lower on the mountain, the lava's starting to slow down, and it splits, and it comes back together like a river delta. And you've got these interconnecting passageways. So that is really interesting. The mineral deposits are interesting. You don't get a lot of rain, and a lot of the caving I've done is on the south side of the island, which is drier. But it still leaches minerals out, and you'll get bluish-colored stalactites. You get a lot of reds. Whew. And some very pretty things you never see in a limestone-type cave. And then you've got melt formations, like things like stalactites that are actually molten rock that are kind of had dripped from the ceiling. You get something like soda straws, which is... gas is shooting out, and then it's depositing a shell of stone around it.
Oh, my gosh.
So there's some intriguing formations.
Wow. And when were you there, thereabouts?
I've been there three times. The last time was about 4 years ago. And I've been the longest lava tube, at least lower parts of that. That one runs from high on Kilauea all the way down. It's about a 14-hour through trip.
Wow.
So I haven't had a chance to do the whole thing. Caving in Hawaii is very expensive. You go caving and your wife goes shopping. So that's what drives the expense.
At least in your experience.
At least in my experience. I've caved on Kauai. There's some really nice caves on that island.
Oh, my gosh.
Swam back to a blue room in one of the caves on the North Shore, which is kind of neat. That's a water cave. So it's unclear whether that was, and really maybe it's a combination of a lava tube that had at one time then eroded away because it was right at the beach area. And so that's really interesting, swimming back into a lava tube.
Oh, that sounds just magical.
It is intriguing. It is a very neat experience. I was hoping to do the Blue Grotto on the island of Capri last year. I was over there, but unfortunately the tides were too high when we were there, so I didn't get a chance to get in.
Yeah, you can't really mess with that.
Yeah, I like air.
Air
at
is
least
good.
At least a little air. It gets to be a problem if you don't have any in the cave.
Well, let's make our way back to Indiana. What are some of your favorite caves in Indiana to visit, other than Sullivan, which we've talked about?
Well, let's talk about different types of caves. So for vertical caves, I really like Freeman's and Green Eye.
Mm. Just basic up and down, about 100
feet. Basic up and down. Gory Hole is not too bad. That's probably the deepest one.
Yeah.
But that one is closed. It's by permit only at this time. So that's also a really nice cave. But those are fun, easy drops. As far as exploring, there's a cave called Bennett Spring Cave that was a lot of fun. That one is a part of the Lost River system. You need a wetsuit. You go crawling through a dry crawlway with a wetsuit baking for a short distance. And then you drop into the water, and you're swimming, wading, and at least waist-deep water for about a mile. You can go back up. Then you can pop up into a room up through a hole in the ceiling. But that's very interesting. A lot of blind cave fish, and that's a neat cave. You need to do that on a dry summer day because it does tend to flood. That one could be a little scary.
Yeah. What would you say is your longest trip, the longest you've spent in a cave?
Probably 24 hours.
Where was that?
That was a long time ago. So
24 hours. I mean,
that's just camping overnight in a cave. So you go in, camp, and fool around, come back out. Now, there are a number of trips in Sullivan's that'll take 12 hours to go up to the rise. I haven't done that one yet.
Mm-hmm.
Would like to probably do that sometime before too long.
I'm in. You want to go?
Yeah. Got a wetsuit?
I do. I do now.
Excellent.
Let's do it. That's been on my list as well. And if you look at a map of Sullivan Cave, I mean, you got the concentrated area down at the southern end where most people just go in and hang out for beginner trips, but then it kind of snakes way, way up to the north. You're talking about visiting the northern terminus?
Yeah, go to the rise.
Yeah.
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 I want to see the Colossus, too. That's a big room that's in there. I have not seen the Colossus.
Yeah, me either. I think I've been as far north as you have. I think you and I did a trip to the quarry room.
I've done several trips to the quarry room.
Yeah, and that's as far as I've been in that cave.
Have you climbed down the far side of the quarry at all, to where you drop into the river again?
Probably not. Yeah. I don't think I remember that.
That's about as far north as I've gotten so far. At that point, you have to switch into a wetsuit anyway if you're going to go any further. So,
if you're listening to this and you've never done any Indiana caving, Sullivan is a good place to start. So give Paul a call. Find his name on the Indiana Karst Conservancy website. And heck, maybe we'll even be able to go with you.
Yeah. And they're usually about three or four trips a month into Sullivan's. I think we've got four scheduled this month. The last one will be this next weekend. And then I've already got two scheduled for next month, pretty good-sized group. So a great group, a great location for beginners.
Really is, because it's got everything. It's really got just about everything. There's not a ton of vertical element to it, which is great for beginners, obviously.
And unfortunately, there's not a lot of good formations. It suffered some vandalism when it was just open.
Mm-hmm.
It's now a gated cave. You have to actually have the key to unlock the gate so you can get into it.
But, as of about 92, 93, something like that?
I don't know what year they put it in, but it's really helped to protect the cave, which is a good thing.
Are there any trips that you went on that you just hated? When it was over, you were like, I'm not going back there again for a long time.
I was mapping a cave called Roberts, and Roberts is the wettest dry cave I have ever been in. First of all, there are a lot of caves called Coon in Indiana, a lot of caves called Saltpeter. Unfortunately, there's also a ton of caves called Roberts.
I was going to say, I've heard of that cave, but I think
there's
a few of them.
No, you haven't. The one you've heard of is actually a fairly nice little one, but this one is less nice. It's actually got some really nice formations and stuff in it, but it's just a miserable little thing. We were mapping it, so you'd go crawling along, and so you had a hand transit, and you were taking sightings and measurements, and that added to the general discomfort. So I had three layers of clothes on, long underwear on, and then a layer of clothes on top of that, then a coveralls on top of that. And this reddish, muddy water would soak through, so I was kind of a brightish, reddish brown over my whole body because everything had oozed in. It's a kind of a miserable cave to not move quickly in. I think if you're just using it for entertainment and there are some other parts that we weren't mapping that were outside of the crawlways, it would have been a much more pleasant experience. And then to get to the area we were mapping, you'd crawl up to this one rock, you'd take your helmet off, set it on top of the rock, you'd reach around the rock, and then pull yourself around the corner with a drop-off where your feet were, and then slither on down the passage. So it was a challenging one to get to where we were mapping in the first place.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Well, how long is that system? Do you think it's fully mapped?
No, I know it's not fully mapped.
It's because it's too miserable to get in and out.
Yeah. The guy who was mapping it has left the country, so he's now living in China.
The hell with this.
No, he was a prolific mapper, but he mapped it as far as he could get anybody. His problem was people would go there and map a couple times, and then they'd realize what a miserable hole it was, and they'd never say yes again. So he was running out of people willing to go that had not already decided that that's not a fun cave. So that would probably be an example of one that not one I'd be eager to go back to.
There have been a few caves that I've visited that I said, you know, I'm never going back there again, but then I did. Do you have a few like that where you did it the first time and you were like, I don't think I'll go back there, and then for somehow it pulls you back in?
Well, some I will avoid for a while and then forget about how painful or unpleasant they were and then go back to them. And some of them are really nice ones, like Wayne's Lost.
Yeah, that's the one I'm thinking of. The first time I went there, I was like, I'm never going back, and I've been back twice.
Yeah, last time I went back there, I pulled a muscle crawling through the crawlway, so it was. I was thinking, yeah, crawling on your stomach for a quarter mile and going through the what-the-hell squeeze partway through that crawlway, not a really encouraging trip. But then there's a great cave once you get through it.
Oh, so, yeah.
So that's what makes it really worthwhile. So, yeah, there are a few that have these unpleasantness. A really well-known cave that I tend not to go back to, but I continue to end up going back to, is Buckner's. And there are a lot of nice places. That one was, again, terribly trashed in the days when too many IU students partied in there. But it's a really neat cave with a lot of diversity. So it's another good beginner's cave. But there's a lot more crawling than in Sullivan. So I tend not to try to take youth groups there. I was asked by a scout troop to take them there, and I asked them what cave they wanted to go to. We want to go to Buckner's. Well, I'd like to go to Sullivan's. I have this really nice cave called Salt. No, we want to go to Buckner's. Okay, so Buckner's has been a challenge sometimes for scouts. You have to count them every so often because there are enough side passageways that, and you'd think a 11 through 15-year-old could watch the kid in front of him and crawl in the same hole. But they seem to have a short attention span, and so you lose them every once in a while.
You've got to keep that head count.
Several times I've had to go back and find a kid and drag him back. So you count fairly often in that cave. So we'd come to one of the points before we counted, and we had all our kids. That's always a plus. So I was sitting talking to them, dads, and they were resting. And I said, well, why did you guys want to go to Buckner's? And one of the dads piped up and said, well, when I was a student at IU, I explored this cave. Two of my friends and I grabbed some flashlights, and we went on in through here, and we got to about here, and our flashlights died. Then we had our lighters, so we tried to use the lighters to see our way out. We kept burning our fingers, so we ended up sitting for 19 hours till somebody else came through the cave and found us. And this,
spelunkers.
And this is a happy experience? So this is why you want your son to visit the cave?
That's probably why they think they have hair on their chest. They want to turn their kid into men by getting lost in a cave.
That would be a cave to get lost in. Fortunately, it's kind of it was known as a self-rescue cave because you got the loop, and enough people were doing the loop. So if you were ill-prepared and went in without knowing what you're doing, eventually somebody would find you and take you back out to the surface.
Yeah. Well, you helped the remapping of that cave that Sean Lewis spearheaded.
I did.
And what were the parts of the cave that you visited to help him with that?
Sadly, I mapped the big room and into the crawlways leading to the Air Force room.
Oh, okay.
So those little narrow passageways with odd angles and short sightings. Actually, for mapping, that wasn't too bad. There were a lot of data because you couldn't see very far before you had to set a survey point and then survey to the next point. But it's relatively dry. It's just tight spaces. Back to the original subject, taking people caving and introducing them to caving.
Yeah.
You get a broad spectrum of people. In that passage, I did have a parent panic, get claustrophobia. So you have to calm them down.
Once they got up into the Air Force room or in the crawlway?
They were panicking in the crawlway. They got to the Air Force room, were kind of shaky, and said, "What's the fastest way out of here?" I said, "Well, about 50 feet up through the rock."
but right now
we're at the midpoint, and you have about the same distance of crawling going either direction. So you have a choice. If you'd like to, we can go back, but we got some big rooms coming up, and so we gave him a chance to rest and calm down. And I will say that person has never been caving again. But
not a great place to figure out that you don't like caving.
No, and it's kind of unusual because you had the long crawl into the cave.
Yeah.
Normally that's where someone would panic and turn around as opposed to that point in the cave.
Yeah, but those crawls up to the Air Force room, they're a little bit tighter than that, I guess.
That is the tightest, well, the second tightest part. On the way out, you do have that one underneath the volcano room where you've got to go up at an odd angle. But that's just a squeeze rather than a crawl.
Yeah. It's a little shorter.
Yeah, a lot shorter.
How'd they do in that one? Do you remember? Or were they calmed down by then? Or at least sedated?
They were not portly, so they got through that pretty easy. Because you can see open space on both sides. The problem with the crawl of the Air Force room is you can't necessarily figure out when it's ever going to open up.
Right. And if you go, and logic tells you to go up, but you really need to go down.
No, don't go up. No.
you gotta go down.
It leads you to a dead end, and that can be disconcerting.
Yeah. Yeah. Where the hell am I?
Yeah. And enough people have gone up that it looks like it's a place that people go to. I think people have been all over that cave. So
I took my buddy's caving there for my bachelor party, and a buddy of mine who was with us was a big guy, and he got stuck at that squeeze near the volcano room.
Ooh.
And I think he was just out of gas. He was just out of, you know, he was just exhausted. Because that can be exhausting going through that circle route. But we had guys behind him and guys in front of him pushing and pulling for about 15 minutes.
Yeah.
But he didn't panic, thankfully.
Yeah, you should be in good shape for caving. And probably if you're really overweight, you should consider another hobby.
He was in decent shape, and he wasn't like one of these huge guys. He was just, you know, he's barrel-chested and a larger guy. But like I said, he was just out of gas, but it worked out okay.
So have you gone through the calcite crawl and the Grand Canyon part of Sullivan's Cave?
I have not.
Yeah, that's interesting. We'll take you there sometime. It's kind of a neat portion. The problem there is the Grand Canyon isn't all that grand, but it's a fairly narrow crack. And then you climb down this crack, and there's a little hole in the bottom, and that leads into Scotto Grotto, and from there to the calcite crawl. So that is kind of a neat little passageway. But barrel-chested reminded me, I had one guy who, you can't compress bone. you don't want to.
You cannot.
And his problem was his chest was just fitting tightly. If you're a little bit overweight, you can generally move your fat around a little bit or get through holes like that, but bone does not compress.
No.
And the other thing is just the length of your legs. That if you're trying to do too sharp a bend, the leg bones do not bend either.
That's the biggest thing in real awkward squeezes is the length of your femur. And I got a long femur, and so I have some trouble sometimes.
Yeah, that's where being short and skinny is an advantage.
There's a lot of places in caving where being short and skinny is an advantage.
Not necessarily an advantage for climbing in caving, but for some of the crawls and some of the narrow passages, it's useful.
Are there any specific caves that are still on your list? Like, I got to go there. I got to see that. I got to try that one.
One I would really love to see, but it's very limited, is Lechuguilla.
Oh, yeah.
About the only way you get in there is about a one-week trip and doing one of the studies. And I just don't have the time nor the connections to do that. But that would be one of my bucket list caves I would really, really like to see.
Well, how many years are you from retirement, would you say?
Probably a couple.
Couple years?
Yeah.
But and you're still fit, and I can't imagine you being any less fit in a couple years.
I doubt that, yeah.
And then taking a week. I mean, you'd certainly have some people who would vouch for you.
Yeah, and I map and I do vertical, so that's pretty much a requirement for that cave. You have to be in good shape as well as skilled in caving.
Any other ones?
No, that's probably the biggest one that's on my list. There are a number of gorgeous caves around the world, and there are always new ones you want to see, but that would be a bucket list cave.
What about in Indiana?
I would like to see Jug Hole. That one's been kind of closed for a while. That's just a pretty little cave.
Yeah, that's what I've heard about Jug Hole.
And I'd like to try to do it when the sun's in the right place. Just like when we did Neversink, the sun was just perfect for some great pictures. If you've got sun pretty near vertical coming down to Jug Hole, I think you get some gorgeous photographs.
What do you get from caving that you don't get from any other activity?
As I've said, the sense of adventure, but the accomplishment, a really good workout.
Yeah.
There are very few activities that use as many muscles or will leave you as sore the morning after as doing a challenging cave.
Yeah. Sporty, as they say.
Sporty, yeah.
A sporty cave.
Avoid anybody who says, how would you like to go do a sporty cave? That's the time to ask for details.
Yeah. You want to be clear on what you mean.
What do you mean by sporty? How much air is there above that water? How long do I have to crawl? How narrow is that hole?
Is there anything about caving that you don't like, that you really don't like? Some people don't like tight spaces. Some people don't like water. Some people don't like exposed climbs. Some people don't like vertical at all. But I know you're not in that category.
No, I like pretty much everything. I do like to have a little air.
Yeah.
When you get into bathtubs, I think 3 inches of airspace is the least I've done, and that's not something I really relish. I normally prefer more air.
Yeah. Do you like doing really wet caves? Wetsuit type caves?
They're okay. It's not first on my list.
No.
I like climbing more than I do like wet caves, but there's some really neat wet caves. So, yeah, and sometimes you need to do that to get to the really interesting parts of other caves. So,
you ever thought about going down and doing some of the Binkley stuff? Have you ever gone down into Binkley?
I have not done Binkley. I would like to go do some of the Binkley stuff.
You probably got an open invitation to go down there. I mean, that cave is up over 43 miles now, something like that?
Yeah, and there's continually new discoveries.
Dye traces have theorized that cave as being a 100-mile system. It's incredible.
It could easily be, and especially now that they're getting into the upper section, which they hadn't broken into before. So that one is also a sporty cave. So depending on what part you go to, it can be quite exciting.
Tight and muddy and wet.
Yeah.
All of the above.
Yeah, unfortunately, there are a lot of really nice caves I like in Indiana that have been closed for some time due to white nose. So I'm hoping at some point the permit system starts to open up for the Hoosier National Forest and for some of the other areas that are now off limits.
Have you looked into any of the new research on white nose or anything like that? Do you have an opinion on it one way or another?
I do have an opinion on the closings. I don't think that has been very constructive. It hasn't slowed the disease at all. It probably at first was the right thing to do just because it was not an understood disease, and anything you could do to control it was probably a good thing. At this point, it's pervasive across the Midwest. It seems to have jumped to the West. It spread bat to bat, so there's not much we can do. Bats tend to like to hang out with each other, and that has allowed the disease to spread. I think the main thing is preserve and protect the populations that are there. One of the things I have read and unfortunately has happened is the closures have meant cavers don't go caving, but vandals still do, unfortunately, and that has resulted in some damage to caves that otherwise may have been more preserved had that not been in place. But
yeah,
that's water over the dam at this point. It's gone.
Mm-hmm. There is some cool research that's being done. Hazel Barton, I'm thinking of, who is working on a project to study how some bats are immune versus other bats.
Yeah, that's interesting. In Europe, it seems to be in the entire population and not hurting them. Whereas in North America, some species, it was an 80, 90, 95% die-off.
Whew.
The good news is I think bat populations are starting to recover now. I'm not sure whether the remaining bats were immune or what, but at this point, there just does seem to be a slow recovery starting.
I think things are about to change. I hope they are.
So for sport caving, that would actually open up a lot of really nice caves, like Breathing Hole, which is a really pretty
cave.
Oh,
yeah, there's a ton of caves down in the Harrison Crawford State Forest, which is, as I said, a state forest, which means all the caves are closed.
Yep.
And it's just honeycombed with caves down there.
Yeah. One of the good things I think that's come from it is more of an emphasis on the owners of caves, the privately held caves now, and I think they were neglected because there were some really great caves in public lands and people didn't have to hassle with owners, so they had ready access. Now I think people, one, maybe respect the owners better and are working harder to develop good owner relations with the folks who do own caves.
Yeah, I know in the CIG specifically, the grotto that we belong to, there have been, for years, really, really great owner relations and, you know, an annual award for landowner of the year and things like that. I mean, I'm really proud of what we've been able to accomplish in the CIG.
And we've done things like work to clean up the caves and the property surrounding it, too. Good conservation is important, and that helps with the owners as well.
Do you have a favorite piece of caving gear?
I would have to say no. I do love my helmet.
Boy, don't you? I do, too.
Standing up in a room that's 1 inch shorter than you are, you get a pretty good velocity by the time you hit that ceiling. So it's a really good idea to have your helmet on. I like my Stenlite. Mm. That one works pretty well. There are getting to be some better systems out there now. So I would have to say I'm really happy with LED lighting and the technology advances.
Do you still have your
I have carbide two carbide lamps.
No, you got carbide lamps. Do you have any carbide?
I do. I have not caved with carbide. And I've got a couple of helmets you can mount carbide lamps to.
Oh, boy.
but that was a more challenging time. First of all, I would not want to do any vertical work with carbide lamps anymore.
Right.
Having a flame on your helmet and aiming that at a nylon rope just is not a good decision. So you don't look at your rope when you're caving with a carbide lamp.
Yeah.
At least not close up. You don't
really need to see anything when you're climbing anyway. You just keep moving up.
Yeah, or down. it just didn't provide as much illumination. And with the real wet caves, you don't want to accidentally drop your carbide and suddenly create a passageway full of acetylene. Because calcium carbide works by dripping water on it, and that forms acetylene, and the acetylene is the flame that provides the light. Nice yellow light. And it was a very effective system at the time. Batteries didn't last long enough. You had incandescent lamps. The filaments would burn out. Caving is a reasonably rugged sport, so you keep banging things. And early flashlights were not up to it.
No, they were not.
So carbide was the way to go, and that stayed for quite a few years. But LEDs have totally changed the scene. They're small. I have 48 hours worth of light and battery power on me, when before I wouldn't have near that length of burn time.
So a good light is a good investment.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Helmet first, good light second. Actually, you can't really separate them too much.
No, you really can't. But a good helmet is a good idea.
Very good idea.
And I've always known you to be a coveralls caver, too.
I do like coveralls because you can strip them off and get most of the mud out. Now, as I mentioned with Robert's cave, it really didn't matter. There was mud on all three layers and ground into the skin. But other than that, generally it works really nice. There's some caves where it gets a little too warm. Hawaii, I'd cave in shorts.
Oh, okay. Interesting. How warm is it down there in the lava tubes?
Oh, about 80.
Is it really? Is it still a lot of humidity too?
Depending on the cave system, no. And depending on what side of the island you're on, again, when you think of Hawaiian islands, the north side are jungles and rainforest. The breezes come up, dump water on that side. Then on the south sides are basically deserts.
Yeah.
So the dry air comes down the sides of the mountains. And we're talking 14,000 feet. So we've got snow on the tops of those in Hawaii on the Big Island. And even on Maui, you're at 10,000 feet. So it's nippy in the morning up there. and it's cooler up at higher elevations. So the caves I'm talking about are down further closer to the shore. And the cave temperature, which is a good point, is the average temperature of the area.
Right.
So it's like fossilized temperature. Here in Indiana, pretty much 55 degrees, nice and warm in winter, nice and cool in summer. Probably a little too cool if you're in water all the time, but which is why wetsuits.
Right.
Hawaii is pretty pleasant all year round. Unless you're at the higher elevations, it's very pleasant in the caves. It's just shadier than being out in the hot sun.
Yeah. Do you have one pair of coveralls?
I have a couple pair.
You have a couple. All right.
And usually I'll have one and then its replacement. The one I've got currently is very close to the replacement stage. I've worn through one of the two layers, and I'm working on the second layer.
Oh.
So, yeah, yeah. And when it retires, I'll start the next one, use it for a while, and then buy another one as that one starts to wear through.
I'm wanting to move to coveralls because I'm sick of people seeing my underwear.
Well, you do have very entertaining underwear. I seem to remember something with shamrocks on it.
Yeah, it was our St. Patty's Day trip into Suicide Cave in Washington County, Indiana.
And that's another thing. With caving, particularly for beginners, you want to give them some general guidance. Old clothes.
Old clothes.
Cave mud will stain your clothes permanently.
You'll never want to wear it in polite society again.
Goodwill's a great place to start out, something that's comfortable. Generally, something that's not going to rip out is a really good idea. Yeah, you might want to look into that.
Yeah. I think I should have retired that pair of pants two trips ago.
Yeah, yeah. Well, live and learn.
Yeah.
But that was other than being a fairly muddy cave, is a fairly fun cave to do. Another good beginner cave.
Yeah, and I've found that Goodwill is just a great place to buy activewear, period, because that stuff can be so expensive. And if you can find some good gems.
Yeah, and caving kills clothes.
Yeah.
And kills boots, too. So the other thing is you want to have a good pair of boots. For beginner's trips, we'll take them to places where tennis shoes are fine.
Yeah.
But you don't want a sprained ankle a quarter mile underground. It makes a long and painful trip back out.
How many kids do you have?
I have three kids of my own.
Right.
But they all have kids. So I've got five grandkids right now.
Five grandkids. You've taken a lot of, well, you've taken your kids caving, and you've taken a lot of your grandkids caving.
My kids both cave and climb. James Mountain climbs as well. And I have taken Mackenzie, and she was just a little over six. So 6, 7 when she started caving. Mm-hmm. She's done several caves. She has her own helmet and gear. So she was asking me if she could go caving, and her younger brother, who's just turned 5 now, it wants to go caving this trip, too, so we're going to probably take him to Sullivan's as an intro. She likes Sullivan's. She likes the bats there. She thinks they're cute and little
and
fuzzy.
Well, they are. They're adorable, and that's good that she's not afraid of them.
Yeah, she wants to take them home. I tell her she can't do that. No, you can't pet the cute little bat. It might bite, but she thinks they're very cute, so she keeps spotting bats and pointing them out and giggling.
They are adorable. They can be. Yeah. I think we kind of covered this earlier, but And I think maybe I could answer my question without you answering it, but tips on inspiring a love of caving in beginners. I think that you're good at taking beginners like your kids and like your grandkids and like scout groups because you have patience and you have knowledge and you're willing to share both of those things.
Yeah, I think that's important. I think it's also important to prepare them for what they're going to see so you don't have any surprises. And we've done the introduction to caving class. We've done at Recreation Equipment Company a few times now. Mm-hmm. I've done that with other youth groups as well. And it gives you a good overview of what you're apt to see, how you can prepare for it, what you need to take, what you shouldn't take. And the other thing that's important is not just patience, but watch the group that you're with. And work to make sure that you don't exhaust the weakest person in the group, because then you get into a lot of trouble. So you really want to pace it so that everybody has a good time and rests. That means that the those in better shape and more eager are probably chomping at the bit a little bit, but it also means that you don't lose anybody in the group and don't get into any serious situations.
You've been in a lot of those. You've led a lot of big groups, big trips, and so you've learned a few things on those trips.
Yeah, you're generally better off if you can stay in a group of 10 or less. But I've taken groups of 30 and larger, and
that is nowhere near the biggest group you've ever taken.
No, I said and larger.
And larger.
And when you're doing that, you want somebody to run sweep so you don't lose anybody between the front and the back.
Right.
And you want to stop, and you want to have a cave that you can do that with. There are some that I don't think I would ever do that with Wayne's Lost. Can you imagine 40 people in that crawlway?
No, I don't want to imagine that.
That's a really unpleasant thought.
Yeah.
And try not to discourage anybody. You want to make sure everybody's in good health. Occasionally we've had people with asthma have had to take back to the surface or have panicked. And you want to have enough leaders so that you can separate and take somebody out if they need to. And usually it's because they have claustrophobia or some fear. And that usually shows up very early in the cave trip. So that works pretty well.
Yeah. Don't wait until you're halfway through the circle route to let your claustrophobia kick
in. No. And I mentioned you don't want to be terribly overweight. The biggest problem usually isn't squeezing through the hole, but it's when you're doing the climbing. You got to be able to lift your leg up and take a high step up. And that seems to be a problem when somebody is severely overweight. Mm-hmm. But there are caves that you're more walking, and if you're taking somebody who really wants to see a cave, you can take them into ones that are more suited. So, again, try to make the cave match the group, both the skill level and what they're trying to accomplish.
Well, Paul Uglum, thank you for being on the Caving Podcast, and thank you for introducing me to caving.
It's a great sport. I'm glad to have you with. It's always been fun caving with you.
A good caver and a great man. Thank you, Paul, for coming by to talk. And thank you for listening. You know, I've reached out to quite a few cavers about coming on the show, and I've had some luck. I've gotten some suggestions via email for future guests. And look, I know some cavers are shy, and some of them are even kind of exclusive when it comes to media and, you know, letting the outside world know about our little secret sport of cave exploration. But what I'm trying to do with this podcast is not only give longtime cavers something to listen to, but to inspire the next generation of cavers to get involved and get underground. And this is where you come in. If you'd like to come on the show, or if you know of someone who would be a great guest, please send me an email at alpineproductions@gmail.com, and we'll work something out. alpineproductions@gmail.com. I can come to you. You can come to me. We could try something over the phone. We can do Skype. We'll figure it out. And remember to support the show by supporting our sponsor, Swego. Visit swegogear.com, if for nothing else than to pick up a sticker or two. I love that no-not sticker. Check that out at swegogear.com. Got to slap one of those on the back windshield. Anyway, I'll see you next month. I'm Matt Pelser. This has been the Caving Podcast. Until next time, kill nothing but time.